This week on Making Contact.
And at that moment, I realized that I had no option but to vote against that.
First of all, you have to love the constituents that you are serving.
Because I expose them and I'm telling the truth. They are telling she is infidel, she is communist.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile three courageous politicians, women creating progressive change through government. United States Congresswoman Barbara Lee represents the 9th District of Northern California. Wu Qing is a people's deputy in China's parliament at the Beijing and district levels. And Malalai Joya is one of the first women to be elected to Afghanistan's parliament. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. In 1998, Barbara Lee was elected to represent the 9th Congressional District of California, which includes the cities of Berkeley, Oakland, and Alameda. Lee is an outspoken critic of the U.S. government's increased military presence abroad. She is the highest-ranking Democratic woman on the U.S. House of Representatives International Relations Committee, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus Task Force on HIV/AIDS, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and she serves on many other task forces and committees, often as the lone voice for peace. But a career in politics was not what Barbara Lee had planned at all.
I never really thought that politics would or could be a calling of mine. I actually got involved in politics when I was a student in Mills College. And we had a course requirement in government to do field work in a political campaign. And during that time, it was McGovern, Muskie, and Humphrey running. And, you know, as a single young mother of two children on public assistance, I looked at these three candidates and said, you know, there's no way that I'm going to work in their campaigns because they don't stand for what I think they should stand for, and they're not going to make my life nor the lives of thousands of people, of women like me, any better. So I told my professor, well, I'll probably just flunk this class. Well, at the same time, we invited Shirley Chisholm to come to campus. And lo and behold, she said she was running for president. Now, Shirley Chisholm was a great woman, first African-American in the United States House of Representatives. And after I heard her speak, and she said she was running for president, I went up and told her that I had this class I was about ready to flunk. But now that I heard her and sounded like she truly was unbought and unbossed, and I could relate to some of the issues she was talking about. She was early on against the war in Vietnam. She was for education and child care. She was bilingual. She was a woman who brought together multiracial coalitions. She just seemed to be the kind of person I could support for president. So I talked to her about this class, and she told me, she said, and I'll never forget this, she says, well, my dear, the first thing you must do is register to vote. And so I said, oh, my gosh, this is what it's going to mean, huh? So what happened was, fast forward, I ended up organizing her Northern California presidential campaign with other classmates out of my class at Mills College. And I passed the class, and we took almost 10% or more of the vote in Alameda County. And that was really my entree into politics. And then I actually worked with the great warrior statesman, Congressman Ron Dellums, as his top person from 1975 to 1982 in Washington, and then went back and worked for him until 1986. And in 1990, people asked me if I would consider running for an open assembly seat in the state legislature, which I ended up doing, but I never thought that this was something that was part of my calling, running for office, and the rest is history.
On September 14, 2001, just 3 days after the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration asked Congress for blanket authorization to wage preemptive war. Barbara Lee earned national and international recognition as the only member of the U.S. Congress to vote against giving Bush that authorization.
the first resolution that I voted against that I found myself alone in voting against was the resolution on September 14th, which really gave this administration and President Bush a blank check to wage war forever against any nation, organization, individual that he deemed responsible for, connected to, or harboring terrorist organizations. I mean, this was a blank check that I thought could lead to more violence, more instability, and would not make America any safer. And it was a very tough vote, but, you know, I went that afternoon to the memorial service at the National Cathedral, and a member of the clergy, I'll never forget this, he in his prayer said, "Let us not become the evil that we deplore." And at that moment, I realized that I had no option but to vote against that. And I did. I started working with many members in our Democratic caucus to talk about why the war against Iraq was a wrong war at the wrong time, at the wrong place, that there were no weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, the world knows now, that, in fact, we should allow the UN to continue with the inspections process. I had an amendment that got, I think, 72 votes on the floor. It was an alternative to the Bush administration's amendment that just said, look, let this inspections process play out. Let the UN do their job. Of course, now in retrospect, when members of Congress look back on that, they were very happy that they voted the 72 for my amendment. And I have seen a sea change in terms of at least stopping to analyze these votes and figure out what to do, which is in the best interest of our country and the constituencies that they represent. Let me give you an example. The No Permanent Bases, which is the bill that I've been working on, we have probably about 75 co-sponsors now, that says basically we don't want to permanently occupy Iraq. That amendment I've been working on for a couple of years, but when the supplemental recently came up, we offered that amendment as part of the supplemental, and that passed by a voice vote. Democrats and Republicans voted for that, and we did it without even a recorded vote. And I think that that's a real testament to organizations on the outside, such as MoveOn.org and other grassroots groups, in terms of the phenomenal kind of impact that they're having here in Washington, D.C. That's a real testament to what's going on in the community and throughout the country and the power of the people.
The U.S. Senate also approved Lee's amendment against a permanent military presence in Iraq. For her anti-war activism, her co-authoring a bill to establish a U.S. Department of Peace, and for her leadership against the genocide in Darfur, Congresswoman Barbara Lee was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize as one of the internationally recognized 1,000 Women for Peace.
Well, we have a Department of War, so we need a Department of Peace. The Department of Peace would be a cabinet-level department that would be responsible for conflict resolution, for seeking diplomatic solutions to the world's problems, but also trying to help us figure out in our communities in America how to get the guns off the streets, how to reduce domestic violence, how do we help young people understand that violence is not an option and reduce the crime rate here in America. So the Department of Peace is a department whose time is coming. I'm very proud to have actually helped write that bill. And it's just a matter of time. But I think the more we talk about it and read that bill, the more people are going to say, yes, this is something that absolutely should happen and should happen quickly.
As an African-American woman, Barbara Lee is deeply aware of the obstacles she and other minority elected officials face in Congress. Lee feels it is her responsibility to help prepare the next generation of political leaders to reflect the diversity of their communities and concerns.
There is a glass ceiling, I think, here in Congress. We all know that Washington, D.C., Capitol Hill has been a bastion, you know, of racism and sexism. And many of us here, there are 14 African-American women in the Congressional Black Caucus, and each and every day we try to shatter some of these glass ceilings. It's very difficult, but we will continue to do that. And so much of my work is with young people. We mentor young people. I have young women in my office, both in Washington, D.C., and in my California office. And recently, my alma mater, Mills College, established, in such a humbling moment for me, they established a chair in women's leadership in my name. And that's to educate more young women to go into civic leadership and political work and government service. I have found some unbelievable young people in the hip-hop community, young people in college, young people who are trying to figure out what to do next. They all come into my office. They all work with me. They go with me on civil rights pilgrimages down to Selma, Montgomery, Birmingham with Congressman John Lewis. They kind of hang out with me and see what I'm doing, and they're learning quite a bit about the history of the civil and human rights movement in America. And I think that we're going to see a new generation, at least those young people in California and in Northern California, they'll be ready to take over when others move on.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. Chinese feminist and legislator Wu Qing traces her commitment to honesty and independence in the political realm to early childhood conversations with her mother. Wu Qing's mother was a Chinese writer famous for poems like this one. A trellis of sticks crowned with chrysanthemums. Right there, you can realize all the self-sufficient universe.
My mother's pen name is Bing Xin. When I was very young, she taught me to have a very strong sense of responsibility, knowing the importance of sense of integrity, honesty, and sharing. And I remember when I was 5 years old, she told me that I'm a human being before I am a girl or a woman. I think that has left a very deep impression on me. So, you know, I never feel that I am inferior to boys or to men, but I know that I have to work hard and to be a down-to-earth person to walk step by step. And then, of course, she has a very, very famous saying, that is, when there is love, there is everything. So I think love is the core of, should be of the core of the world and of the relationship between peoples. First of all, you have to love the constituents that you are serving. So with that love, you will try to go and find out about the basic needs and demands of the people. I'm a people's deputy. That is one of the legislators at district level, as well as at Beijing municipal level. But I find it more valuable to work at grassroots. So I set aside every Tuesday afternoon since 84 to meet with my constituents. In fact, I started this in China. I was the first person to do it. Then people started every Tuesday afternoon to come to tell me their complaints, like they said they would like to start a new bus line, or they said that the latrines were not clean, or there were no street lights, or the roads should be widened.
In addition to working on resolving the daily issues of local urban politics, Wu Qing has been a strong advocate in the People's Congress for the rule of constitutional law. She views the rule of law as crucial to China's stability and peace.
China has had 2,400 years of feudalism, a long, long time. It had always been top down, and then there has never been democracy, transparency, nor supervision. In our culture, people usually pin their hopes on a kind, benevolent emperor, and who would, like a father figure, take care of his subjects. So we do not have a system of checks and balance, and that's why there's been so much corruption. I want China to be a country, rule of law by law. You have to do it. You have to do it on behalf of the people, on behalf of your constituents. But I use the Constitution to evaluate the work or to monitor or supervise the work of the government. If everybody should use the Constitution, then gradually China will be a country, rule of law. Because I went through the political movements, especially the Cultural Revolution in China, there was no law. Though we had the Constitution, nobody respected. That's why people suffered. It was a great chaos. It was a nightmare. I don't want this to happen again. And that's why I think it's so important to have rule of law.
Throughout her 5 terms as a district deputy and 4 terms as a deputy representing Beijing, Wu Qing is leading efforts to improve conditions for women throughout China. She helped establish a telephone hotline so that women would not be isolated if they needed somewhere to turn for help. One of Wu Qing's proudest achievements is opening a practical skills training center for rural women and co-founding the Rural Women's Knowing All magazine.
I started to pay more and more attention to my sisters in the rural areas in 1990. I visited Gansu, which is in the western part of China, a very dry area. You know, the car would drive like for 5 or 6 hours. I didn't see anything green. No. So water is scarce. And then I found out actually a lot of people were living in poverty and they were hungry. Water was a problem. And I didn't know about that. You know, because I come from an elite family, to me, poverty is very abstract. I only saw that in films. But in that summer, I saw it with my own eyes. Children didn't wear any shoes. You know, they were hungry, not much water. They had to work hard. And then just the peasants wanted to have sons because sons could do the heavy work to improve the lives of the family. So then I just said to myself, China is still a third world country. To change China, you have to change the rural areas. If you want to change the rural areas, you have to change women. Because if you change one woman, you change your whole family and generations to come. But if you change one man, just one man. So it seems then, since then, I've made rural women the focus of my future, at least the cause that I'm going to fight for. The magazine, in a way, then represents rural women, the voice of rural women. And then there are columns on law, on sex, on marriage, divorce. And because we have the magazine as a vehicle, we get feedback from rural women. They said, we want literacy classes. And that's why we try to raise funding and start the literacy classes for women. That was in 1996. Usually we make sure that like there are 30 women coming into the class so that they could do things together. You know, very often the first time when we encourage them to share their names, because we use participatory methodology, the first time, you know, they would murmur their name. They would say, well, my name is so, and they had their head lowered. And then gradually you see them changed, so confident, still talk to you and look at you in the eye, this eye contact, right? I remember there was one woman who was in her late 40s. After she took the exam, the last exam, she came up and held my hand. He said, "Professor Wu, thank you so much for helping me to learn how to read and write. Now I can write my name and I make sure that all my three daughters will be educated." I thought that is so, so important. That's empowerment. But I think the most important thing is we should get more women's voices heard at grassroots. For example, now at village level, I think there's only around 1% of women either being the head of a village or the party secretary of the village. That is not enough, because women's voices have to be heard.
When the voice of Delegate Malalai Joya was first heard in Afghanistan's new national parliament, many of her fellow delegates demanded that she be removed from the legislative chambers. The chairman only backed away from forcing Joya out because other delegates defended her right to speak. But Joya continues to receive death threats for her stinging condemnation of the warlords from Afghanistan's Northern Alliance, whom she accuses of corruption, violence, and contempt for the rights of women.
"Unfortunately, after the domination of Taliban, there is no fundamental change in the lives of the women of Afghanistan. Because U.S. replaced instead of Taliban, Northern Alliance. They are those people that when they were in power from 1992 to 1996, they killed lots of innocent people in Afghanistan. They kidnapped them, they raped them, they even didn't get them to go to schools. They did different kinds of crimes against women and girls in Afghanistan. But unfortunately, once again, by the mask of democracy, they come in power. And this is the main reason that there is no fundamental change in the situation of the women of Afghanistan right now. Now, women of Afghanistan, they have two kind of problem. In one hand, our country is male-dominated society. But the main problem of our people is this, that our country is warlordism country. Because those people that they were against women rights, until now they are against women rights, they are in power. In this situation, even they are burning some schools, girls' schools in the faraway provinces. They are warning the girls do not go to schools, to go to the literacy courses and like this. In my opinion, when half of the population of a country, when they do not have liberation, when they do not have education, how the country can improve? So the main message of our people is this, that if US and US allies wants to bring real democracy for our country, please stop the support of the tested enemies of Afghanistan. Unfortunately, we saw that majority seats of the parliaments has been taken by different types of the warlords. Now we have 68 women, they are members of the parliament from 249 seats. 68 seats belongs to women. But these women, they are different women in the parliament. Some of them, they have compromised with these warlords. But in another hand, there are some Democrat and freedom-loving women and men inside of the parliaments. They are delegates that they do not have bloody hand in the history of Afghanistan. And they want to do something for rebuilding of their country, of our country. So I want to be unite with them.
Despite the risks, Malalai Joya continues to speak truth to power in an attempt to bring a genuine democratic process to her country. Even though the news media in Afghanistan are afraid to interview her, and she has been depicted as an enemy of Islam, Joya refuses to remain silent.
Most of members of parliament, they had a speech. When I have a speech, because I expose them and I'm telling the truth. In one hand, they stopped me and they do not let me to have a speech. They turn off the microphone and they are hitting on the desks and they are threatening me to death. And they are telling me that nobody wants to listen to your speech and to your talk and like this. And because someone, if exposed them, they are telling she is infidel, she is communist, she is this and this. Under the name of Islam, these people, they are doing crimes against our people. The main reason is this, why these people, they are against secularism. Because they know that if we have secular government in Afghanistan, they cannot do to their crimes under the name of Islam. Because of this, as a Muslim woman, I believe in secularism.
Malalai Joya knows only too well the terrible sufferings of her people. During her own childhood, her family became war refugees, like so many families around her. Despite that, she is surprisingly optimistic.
My childhood is like the childhood of the thousands, war generation of Afghanistan. We saw nothing in our lives. I was only 4 days baby that Russian attacked in Afghanistan. I was only 3 years old that I become as refugee with my family to Iran. After that, when I become 7 years old, we become refugee to Pakistan. And then in Pakistan, when I finished school, I went to Herat under the domination of Taliban. I was only 19 years old. I think it's not easy. This struggle is very prolonged struggle. And I know about hardships, about sacrifices, about death threats, about even one day they will kill me physically. They will do something physically against me. I'm a person. They kill lots of innocent people, but they never can stop the spring. They will cut all of the flowers. They will never can stop the spring. One day we will have democracy, liberation in our country. And this is my hope.
And that's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Stephanie Welch for production assistance. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. You can also order a CD of this program at radioproject.org or call the National Radio Project toll-free at 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio, additional music by Charlie Hayden, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, and Delka. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, senior producer Tina Rubio, producer Justin Beck, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Stefana Petrova and Alina Potts, production interns, Yasuyo Nagata and Akila Bridgeford, volunteers. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins. Thanks for listening.